The government wanted to keep the weapons secret, but they couldn't always hide their appearance in the skies. So it is alleged that they chose a number of people to use to spread the rumour that these were really alien visitations. One of those chosen was called Paul Benovitz, who lived outside a giant airbase in New Mexico and had noticed strange things going on.
Years later, I sat down with Paul at dinner and told Paul exactly that everything we did was a sanctioned counterintelligence operation to convince him that what he was seeing was UFOs, and that what we didn't want him to know was that he tapped into something on the base, and we didn't want him to ever disclose that. We kind of planted the seed in Paul that what he was seeing and what he was hearing and what he was collecting was, in fact, probably maybe UFOs.
Benovitz and others chosen by the agency were, it is alleged, given a series of forged documents. Many of them were top-secret memos by the military describing sightings of unidentified aerial vehicles. The documents spread like wildfire, and they formed the basis for the wave of belief in UFOs that would spread through America in the 1990s.
What the fuck is that, nigga? That's crazy, bro. Is that space,
And it also fueled the wider, growing belief that governments lied to you, that conspiracies were real. What the Reagan administration were doing, both with Colonel Gaddafi and with the UFOs, was a blurring of fact and fiction. But it was part of an even broader program. The president's advisors had given it a name. They called it perception management, and it became a central part of the American government during the 1980s. The aim was to tell dramatic stories that grabbed the public imagination. Not just about the Middle East, but about Central America and the Soviet Union. And it didn't matter if the stories were true or not, providing they distracted people, and you, the politician, from having to deal with the intractable complexities of the real world.
Reality became less and less of an important factor in American politics. It wasn't what was real that was driving anything, or the facts driving anything. It was how you could turn those facts, or twist the facts, or even make up the facts to make your opponent look bad. So perception management became a device, and the facts could be twisted. Anything could be anything. It becomes, how can you manipulate the American people?
And in the process, reality becomes what?
Reality becomes simply something to play with to achieve that end. Reality is not important in this context. Reality is simply something that you handle.
But something was about to happen that would demonstrate dramatically just how far the American government had detached from reality. The Soviet Empire was about to implode. And no one, none of the politicians or the journalists, all the think tank experts, all the economists, all the academics saw it coming. collapse of the Soviet Union also had a powerful effect on the West. For many, it symbolized the final failure of the dream that politics could be used to build a new kind of world. What was going to emerge instead was a new system that had nothing to do with politics. A system whose aim was not to try and change things, but rather to manage a post-political world. One of the first people to describe this dramatic change was a left-wing German political thinker called Ulrich Beck. Beck said that any politician who believed that they could take control of society and drive it forward to build a better future was now seen as dangerous. In the past, politicians might have been able to do this, but now they were faced with what he called a runaway world, where things were so complex and interconnected, and modern technologies so potentially dangerous, that it was impossible to predict the outcomes of anything you did. The catalogue of environmental disasters proved this. Politicians would have to give up any idea of trying to change the world. Instead, their new aim would be to try and predict the dangers in the future, and then find ways to avoid those risks. Although Beck came from the political left, the world he saw coming was deeply conservative. The picture he gave was of a political class reduced to trying to steer society into a dark and frightening future, constantly peering forward and trying to see the risks coming towards them. Their only aim, to avoid those risks and keep society stable.
It only lasted for a few seconds, so you're basically shocked. You really didn't know what was going on at the time.
Where were you in the building, and where was the explosion? Oh, my God!
But a system that could anticipate the future and keep society stable was already being built, pieced together from all kinds of different and sometimes surprising sources, all of them outside politics. One part of it was taking shape in a tiny town in the far northwest of the United States called East Wenatchee. It was a giant computer whose job was to make the future predictable. The man building it was a banker called Larry Fink. Back in 1986, Mr. Fink's career had collapsed. He lost $100 million in a deal and had been sacked. He became determined it wouldn't happen again. Fink started a company called BlackRock and built a computer he called Aladdin. It is housed in a series of large sheds in the apple orchards outside Wenatchee. Fink's aim was to use the computer to predict with certainty what the risk of any deal or investment was going to be. The computer constantly monitors the world, and it takes things that it sees happening and then compares them to events in the past. It can do this because it has in its memory a vast history of the past 50 years, not just financial, but all kinds of events. Out of the millions and millions of correlations, the computer then spots possible disasters, possible dangers lying in the future, and moves the investments to avoid any radical change and keep the system stable.
Today I'm going to deliver 1.8 million reports.
Execute 25,000 trades.
And avert 3,000 disasters.
I'm going to monitor interest rates in Europe.
Silver prices in Asia.
Droughts in the Midwest.
I'm going to witness 4 billion shares change hands on the New York Stock Exchange.
And record the effects on 14 trillion in assets across 20,000 portfolios.
I am Aladdin.
I am Aladdin.
And today, I'll find the numbers behind the numbers.
I will see the trends the models don't.
The connections.
The risks.
I am Aladdin.
I am Aladdin, and I will get the data right.
I am 25 million lines of code.
Written by hundreds of people.
Across two decades.
I'm smarter than any algorithm.
More powerful than any processor.
Because I am Aladdin.
Because I am Aladdin.
I am Aladdin.
I am Aladdin.
Aladdin has proved to be incredibly successful. The assets it guides and controls now amount to $15 trillion, which is 7% of the world's total wealth. But Wenatchee was also a dramatic example of another kind of craving for stability and reassurance. More of its citizens took Prozac than practically any other town in America.
When a person's central nervous system is changed by an SSRI with that medicine, they will view things differently, and they will be strangers. They look at things differently. I have a chemical up here that changes me. I think differently. For me, it was like walking around like this for my whole life and really not knowing that I was nearsighted. I mean, really. I mean, no one had ever offered me glasses. And then all of a sudden, here comes somebody that says, okay, now try these on. Try this Prozac on. And I tried it on, and for the first time in my life, I went, whoa, is this the way reality really is? Your perception can be changed, and it's frightening, and it's scary to people. It speaks of science fiction almost.
Well, the medicine just kind of lets you be, you listen to what needs to go on. And then your doctor, you know, every time you come back, he says, you're looking so much better. And then he just, like Jim, he every time I come in, he goes, you are so beautiful, you know? And he isn't even sucking up. I mean, he's being nice, you know. You're beautiful, you're nice, you're friendly, you've got so much going for you. And I think, yeah, I do, yeah. So I go out and I tell my friends, oh, I feel so much better about myself. You know, mom goes out, oh, I feel so much better about myself. So your friends start saying, you know, I've seen such an improvement. I've seen such improvement, and everybody improves all the way around. They see improvement, you know, it's like everybody's kind of brainwashing each other into being happy.
But there was a more effective way of reassuring people that was being developed that did not involve medication. It too came from computer systems, but this time artificial intelligence. But the way to do it had been discovered by accident. Back in the 1960s, there had been optimistic dreams that it would be possible to develop computers that could think like human beings. Scientists then spent years trying to program the rules that governed human thought. But they never worked. One computer scientist at MIT became so disillusioned that he decided to build a computer program that would parody these hopeless attempts. He was called Joseph Weizenbaum, and he built what he claimed was a computer psychotherapist. Just like a therapist, people could come and talk to the machine by typing in their problems. Weizenbaum called the program Eliza. He modelled it on a real psychotherapist called Carl Rogers, who was famous for simply repeating back to the patient what they had just said. That is what Eliza did. The patient sat in front of the screen and typed in what they were feeling. And the program repeated it back to them, often in the form of a question.
Men are all alike.
In what way?
They're always bugging us about something or other.
Can you think of a specific example?
Well, my boyfriend made me come here.
Your boyfriend made you come here?
He says I'm depressed much of the time.
I'm sorry to hear that you're depressed.
It's true. I am unhappy.
Do you think coming here will help you not to be unhappy?
Well, I need some help. That much seems certain.
One of the first people to use Eliza was Weizenbaum's secretary. And her reaction was something that he had not predicted at all.
And I asked her to my office and sat her down at the keyboard, and then she began to type. And, of course, I looked over her shoulder to make sure that everything was operating properly. After two or three interchanges with the machine, she turned to me and she said, "Would you mind leaving the room, please?"
And yet she knew, as Weizenbaum did, that Eliza didn't understand a single word that was being typed into it.
You're like my father in some ways. You don't argue with me.
Why do you think I don't argue with you?
You're afraid of me.
Does it please you to think I'm afraid of you?
My father's afraid of everybody. My father's afraid of everybody.
Weizenbaum was astonished. He discovered that everyone who tried Eliza became engrossed. They would sit for hours telling the machine about their inner feelings and incredibly intimate details of their lives. They also liked it because it was free of any kind of patronising elitism. One person said, "After all, the computer doesn't burn out, look down on you, or try to have sex with you." What Eliza showed was that in an age of individualism, what made people feel secure was having themselves reflected back to them, just like in a mirror. Artificial intelligence changed direction and started to create new systems that did just that, but on a giant scale. They were called intelligent agents. They worked by monitoring individuals, gathering vast amounts of data about their past behaviour, and then looked for patterns and correlations from which they could predict what they would want in the future. It was a system that ordered the world in a way that was centred around you. And in an age of anxious individualism, frightened of the future, that was reassuring. Just like Eliza. A safe bubble that protected you from the complexities of the world outside. But the applications of this new direction proved fruitful and profitable. If you liked that, you'll love this. What was rising up in different ways was a new system that promised to keep the world stable. Its tentacles reached into every area of our lives. Finance promised that it could control the unpredictability of the free market. While individuals were more and more monitored to stabilise their physical and mental states. And increasingly, the intelligent agents online predicted what people would want in the future and how they would behave. But the biggest change was to politics. In a world where the overriding aim was now stability, politics became just part of a wider system of managing the world. The old idea of democratic politics, that it gave a voice to the weak against the powerful, was eroded. And a resentment began to quietly grow out on the edges of society. But the new system did have a dangerous flaw. Because in the real world, not everything can be predicted by reading data from the past. And someone who was about to discover that to his own cost was Donald Trump. One day, a man called Jess Markham received a phone call. It was from Donald Trump. And Trump was desperate for help. Markham was a strange, mysterious figure. He had been a nuclear scientist in the 1950s and studied the effect of radiation from nuclear weapons on the human body. Then Markham had gone to Las Vegas and become obsessed by gambling. He had a photographic memory, and he used it to instantly process the data of the games as they were played. From that, he could predict the outcome. And he always won. The Las Vegas gangsters were fascinated by him. They called him the Automat.
Where are we going? Let's go.
Donald Trump was one of the heroes of the age. But in reality, much of his success was a facade. The banks that had lent Trump millions had discovered that he could no longer pay the interest on the loans.
You're right.
Trump's empire was facing bankruptcy. His wife Ivana hated him because he was having an affair with Miss Hawaiian Tropic 1985. And then, a famous Japanese gambler called Akio Kashiwagi came to one of Trump's casinos and started to win millions of dollars in an extraordinary run of luck. Trump, who was desperate for money, panicked as day after day he watched millions being siphoned out of his casino. So he turned for help to Jess Markham. Markham came to Trump's casino in Atlantic City. He analysed all the data about the way that Kashiwagi had been playing. He then told Trump to suggest a particular high-stakes game that he knew the Japanese gambler could not resist. His model, Markham said, predicted that Kashiwagi had to lose. And after five agonising days, he did. Kashiwagi lost $10 million and he gave up. Donald Trump was elated. He thought he'd got his money back. Before Kashiwagi could pay his debt, he was hacked to death in his kitchen by Yakuza gangsters. And Donald Trump didn't get his money. Trump's business went bankrupt, and he was forced to sell most of his buildings to the banks. And he married Miss Hawaiian Tropic. In the future, he would sell his name to other people to put on their buildings. And he himself would become a celebrity tycoon. President Assad didn't want stability. He wanted revenge. In December 1988, a bomb exploded on a Pan Am plane over Lockerbie in Scotland. Almost immediately, investigators and journalists pointed the finger at Syria. The bombing had been done, they said, in revenge for the Americans shooting down of an Iranian airliner in the Gulf a few months before. And for 18 months, everyone agreed that this was the truth. But then, a strange thing happened. The security agencies said that they had been wrong. It hadn't been Syria at all. It was Libya who had been behind the Lockerbie bombing. But many journalists and politicians did not believe it. They were convinced that the switch had happened for the most cynical of reasons. That America and Britain desperately needed Assad as an ally in the coming Gulf War against Saddam Hussein. So once again, they blamed Colonel Gaddafi as the terrorist mastermind.
Well, Syria, of course, was unfortunately accused of many terrorist outrages and of harbouring terrorist groups. It appears that we have now restored relations with them, as have the Americans. They're now our friends, although we get no real assurances on the past whatsoever. It strikes me as very strange indeed that many of the things we thought were previously the responsibility of Syria have now dramatically become the responsibility of Libya.
But Assad was not really in control, because he had released forces that no one would be able to control. The force that 10 years before he had brought from Iran to attack the West, the human bomb, was now about to jump, like a virus, from Shia to Sunni Islam. In December 1992, the militant group Hamas kidnapped an Israeli border guard. and stabbed him to death. The Israeli response was overwhelming. They arrested 415 members of Hamas, put them on buses, and took them to the top of a bleak mountain in southern Lebanon. They left them there and refused to allow any humanitarian aid through. But the Israelis had dumped the Hamas militants in an area controlled by Hezbollah. They spent 6 months there, and during that time, they learned from Hezbollah how powerful suicide bombing could be. Hezbollah told them how they had used it to force the Israelis out of Beirut and back to the border. The first sign that the idea had spread to Hamas was when a group of the deportees marched in protest towards the Israeli border, dressed as martyrs, as the Israelis shelled them. But it soon became more than just theatre. Hamas began a wave of suicide attacks in Israel.
Just before nine, at the height of Tel Aviv's rush hour, the bomb ripped apart a commuter bus. An amateur cameraman recorded the scene in the moments afterwards as a dazed woman was helped out of the smouldering wreckage.
I didn't want to believe that under my house there is a bomb. And when I realized it's a bomb, I started to cry because it was the first time I saw it in Tel Aviv.
Hamas sent the bombers into the heart of Israeli cities to blow themselves up and kill as many around them as possible. In doing this, Hamas were going much further than Hezbollah ever had. They were targeting civilians, something Hezbollah had never done. The tactic shocked the Sunni world. This was something completely alien to its history. Not only did the Quran forbid suicide, but Sunni Islam did not have any rituals of self-sacrifice, unlike the Shias. The most senior religious leader in Saudi Arabia insisted it was wrong. But a mainstream theologian from Egypt, called Sheikh Qaradawi, seized the moment. He issued a fatwa that justified the attacks. And, he added, it was also justified to kill civilians. Because in Israel, everyone, including women, serve as reservists. So really, they are all part of the enemy army.
It's not suicide. It is martyrdom in the name of God. Islamic theologians and jurisprudents have debated this issue. Israeli women are not like women in our society because Israeli women are militarized. Secondly, I consider this type of martyrdom operation as indication of justice of Allah Almighty. Allah is just. Through His infinite wisdom, He has given the weak what the strong do not possess, and that is the ability to turn their bodies into bombs like the Palestinians do.
Hamas kept sending the bombers into Israel, sometimes day after day. The horror overwhelmed Israeli society, and it completely destroyed the ability of politics to solve the Palestinian crisis. Instead, in the Israeli election of 1996, Benjamin Netanyahu took power. He turned against the peace process, which was exactly what Hamas wanted. And from then on, the two sides became locked together in ever more horrific cycles of violence. The human bomb had destroyed the very thing that President Assad had first wanted, a real political solution to the Palestinian question.
It was just after 1 o'clock, and the market was full of shoppers. Streams of ambulances came to carry away the dead and the injured. It was a place of appalling suffering. But even with the first grief came the immediate political impact on the peace process.
It's impossible. This moment, it will be the end. Must be the end of this bloody peace process.
And in America, all optimistic visions of the future had also disappeared. Instead, everyone in society, not just the politicians, but the scientists, the journalists, and all kinds of experts, had begun to focus on the dangers that might be hidden in the future. This, in turn, created a pessimistic mood that then began to spread out from the rational technocratic world and infect the whole of the culture. And everyone became possessed by dark forebodings, imagining the very worst that might happen. The attacks in September 2001 were suicide bombs, but now on a huge scale. They demonstrated the terrifying power of this new force to penetrate all defences. They had come to kill thousands of Americans on their own soil. Twenty years before, President Reagan had been confronted by the first suicide bombers. They had been unleashed by President Assad of Syria to force America out of the Middle East. But rather than confront the complexity of Syria and Israel and the Palestinian problem, America had retreated and left Syria and suicide bombing to fester and mutate. They had gone instead for Colonel Gaddafi and turned him into an evil global terrorist. But in the process, this changed the way people saw and understood terrorism. Instead of a violence born out of political struggles for power, it became replaced by a much simpler image of an evil tyrant at the head of a rogue state, who became more like an arch criminal who wanted to terrorize the world. All the politics and power dropped away. The problem was just them and their evil personalities. And after 9/11, this led to a new and equally simple idea. That if only you could remove these tyrannical figures, then the grateful people of their country would transform naturally into a democracy. Because they would be free of the evil.
We owe it to the future of civilization not to allow the world's worst leaders to develop and deploy and therefore blackmail freed-loving countries with the world's worst weapons.
We know they've already got chemical and biological weapons there. We know that they're certainly doing their best to acquire nuclear weapons technology. If we allow them to do that and do nothing about it, then I think later generations will consider us deeply irresponsible.
Both Tony Blair and George Bush became possessed by the idea of ridding the world of Saddam Hussein. So possessed that they believed any story that proved his evil intentions. And the line between reality and fiction became ever more blurred. In September 2002, the head of MI6 rushed to Downing Street to tell Blair excitedly that they had finally found the source that confirmed everything. The source, he said, had direct access to Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons program, which was making vast quantities of VX and sarin nerve agents. The nerve agents were being loaded into linked hollow glass spheres. But then someone in MI6 noticed that the detail the source was describing was identical to scenes in the 1996 movie The Rock, starring Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage.
Really elegant string of pearls configuration. Unfortunately, incredibly unstable.
And what exactly does this stuff do?
If the rocket renders it aerosol, it can take out the entire city of people.
How?
It's a cholinesterase inhibitor. Stops the brain from sending nerve messages down the spinal cord.
A later report into the Iraq War pointed out glass containers were not typically used in chemical munitions.
Seizes your nervous system. Do not move that!
And the informant had obviously seen a popular movie known as The Rock, that had inaccurately depicted nerve agents being carried in glass beads or spheres.
After your skin melts off.
Oh my God.
That there is a threat
from Saddam Hussein, and the weapons of mass destruction that he has acquired is not in doubt at all.
Hafez al-Assad had died in 2000. His son Bashar became the new president of Syria. But he couldn't escape the inexorable logic of what his father had started. 20 years before, his father had sent Shiite suicide bombers to attack the Americans in Lebanon. Now, as America and Britain invaded Iraq, Bashar decided that he would copy his father. But what he was about to let loose would tear the Arab world apart and then come back to try to destroy him. Bashar Assad was never supposed to have been president. It was always going to have been his elder brother, Basil. But then Basil had died in a car crash. So now, Bashar took over the giant palace that his father had built above Damascus. Up to this point, Bashar had not been interested in politics. He was fascinated by computers. He founded the Syrian Computer Society and brought the internet to the country. His favourite band was the Electric Light Orchestra. But now he was president. And he set out to attack America. Bashar Assad was convinced that the invasion of Iraq was just the first step of a plot by the Western powers to take over the whole of the Middle East. He knew that the invasion had outraged many of the radical Islamists in Syria, and what they most wanted to do was to go to Iraq and kill Americans. So Bashar instructed the Syrian intelligence services to help them do this. Syrian agents set up a pipeline that began to feed thousands of militants across the border and into the heart of the insurgency. And it grew. Within a year, almost all the foreign fighters from across the world were coming through Syria. And they brought suicide bombing with them. The Americans estimated that 90% of the suicide bombers in Iraq were foreign fighters. But it began to run out of control. Most of the jihadists had joined the group Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that then turned to killing Shiites in an attempt to create a civil war. And the force that had originally been invented by the Shiites, suicide bombing, now returned and started to kill them.
Then this. A moment of silence before people realised what was happening.
A few seconds ago, we just had repeated explosions in the street below me. People are now fleeing in terror from the central square around the mosque. This is what everybody feared. We just heard another explosion in the distance, that somebody would try to target this religious festival to try to bring about a sectarian conflict in Iraq.
There was panic, a terrified stampede. But some of these people were running into the next bombs. We counted at least 6 separate explosions.
Tony Blair and George Bush were faced by disaster. Iraq was imploding. While at home, they were being accused of lying to their own people to justify the invasion. What they desperately needed was something that would show that the invasion was having a good effect in the Arab world. So they made an extraordinary decision. They turned for help to the man who they had always insisted was one of the world's most dangerous tyrants. Colonel Gaddafi. And instead, they set out to make him their new best friend. It was going to be the highest achievement of perception management. A man who had been created by the West as a fake global supervillain was now going to be turned into a fake hero of democracy. And everyone, not just politicians, would become involved. Public relations, academics, television presenters, spies, and even musicians were all going to help reinvent Colonel Gaddafi. It would show just how many people in the Western establishment had by now become the engineers of this fake world. Ever since he had been accused of the Lockerbie bombing, Colonel Gaddafi had been a complete outcast. The West had imposed sanctions on Libya, and the economy was falling apart. But then suddenly, Tony Blair broke live into the BBC Evening News.
The Prime Minister, Tony Blair, is about to make a statement, the BBC understands, from Downing Street. It's of international significance. He'll be making his statement at any moment. Now we can see pictures of him in Durham,
this evening,
Durham City. Here he is.
Colonel Gaddafi has confirmed that Libya has in the past sought to develop weapons of mass destruction capabilities. Libya has now declared its intention to dismantle its weapons of mass destruction completely. This decision by Colonel Gaddafi is an historic one and a courageous one, and I applaud it.
Today in Tripoli, the leader of Libya, Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi, publicly confirmed his commitment to disclose and dismantle all weapons of mass destruction programs in his country.
Colonel Gaddafi now became, for Western politicians, a heroic figure. His decision to give up his weapons of mass destruction seemed to prove that the invasion of Iraq could transform the Middle East. And Tony Blair travelled to meet Gaddafi in his desert tent, to welcome him back into what one journalist called the community of civilised nations. But as in the past, nothing was what it seemed with Colonel Gaddafi. In reality, Gaddafi did not really have the terrifying weapons of mass destruction that he was promising to destroy. His nuclear program had stuttered to a halt long ago and never produced anything dangerous. He had managed to buy some equipment on the black market, but his technicians had been unable to assemble it. His biological weapons were non-existent. All he had was some old mustard gas in leaking barrels. But now, he had to pretend to have a terrifying arsenal of weapons. And the West had to pretend that they had avoided another global threat. And then the made-up stories became even more complicated. As part of the deal, the West said that if Gaddafi admitted that Libya had done the Lockerbie bombing, then they would lift the sanctions. Many of those who had investigated Lockerbie were still convinced that Libya hadn't done it, that really it had been Syria. But Colonel Gaddafi confessed. His son Saif was interviewed about this confession. He said that his father was simply pretending that he had been behind the Lockerbie bombing to get the sanctions lifted, that new lies were being built on top of old lies to construct a completely make-believe world.
You have to accept, or you had to accept at that time, the responsibility, because you have to accept responsibilities, you have to pay compensation in order to get rid of the sanction. It means we did that not because we are convinced that we did it, but because to find an exit out of this nightmare.
So what you're saying is that you accept responsibility, but you're not admitting that you did it?
Yes.
And this is all a sham, you're saying, just to get sanctions over with so that you can start normal diplomatic relations with
okay.
the West.
Okay. What's wrong with that?
It's a very cynical way to behave as a country, isn't it? Many people would say.
First of all, I mean, the Americans and the British, they told us to write that letter. they told us to pay compensation. And then they opened their embassies and they restored the relation and they came to us. It was their game, not our game.
Does the leader know there's a picture on the television? Are you going to tell him? Oh, good. Thank you.
Public relations companies then came to Libya to do what they called reframing the narrative. One firm was paid $3 million to turn Gaddafi into what they described as a modern world thinker.
Is that going to be there or not?
Okay. Going in 10.
They did this by bringing other famous world thinkers and TV presenters out to Libya to meet the colonel and discuss his theories.
Hello and welcome to Libya in the Global Age, a conversation with Muammar Gaddafi. But first, let's get the story so far of Libya.
One world thinker was called Lord Anthony Giddens. Coincidentally, he had a theory which he called the Third Way, which had inspired Tony Blair. Colonel Gaddafi's own theory was called the Third Universal Theory. Lord Giddens later wrote about his talks with the Libyan leader. Colonel Gaddafi likes my term, the Third Way, because his own political philosophy is a version of this idea. He makes many intelligent and perceptive points. I leave enlivened and encouraged.
After 40 years, the leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi.
And then Colonel Gaddafi achieved his lifelong dream. He was invited to address the United Nations. He spent almost 2 hours explaining his third universal theory and also demanded an investigation into the shootings of President Kennedy and Martin Luther King. When he was in New York, Gaddafi was offered a tent, just like the one he had at home, in the gardens of a grand mansion. The man who made the offer was Donald Trump.
I mean, I've dealt with everybody. And by the way, I could tell you something else.
What?
I dealt with Gaddafi.
What
did you do with Gaddafi?
You buried the lead. What'd you do?
Yeah. Excuse me. I rented him a piece of land. He paid me more for one night than the land was worth for the whole year or for 2 years. And then I didn't let him use the land. That's what we should be doing.
Was that over in New Jersey?
I don't want to use the word screw, but I screwed him. That's what we should be doing.
People in Britain and America now began to turn away from politics. The effect of the Iraq War had been very powerful. Not only did millions of people feel that they had been lied to over the weapons of mass destruction, but there was a deeper feeling that whatever they did or said had no effect. That despite the mass protests and the fears and the warnings, the war had happened anyway. Liberals, radicals, and a whole new generation of young people retreated. They turned instead to another world that was free of this hypocrisy and the corruption of politics. They went into cyberspace. Cyberspace had become even more sophisticated and responsive to human interaction. The online world was full of algorithms that could analyse and predict human behaviour. The man behind much of this was a scientist called Judea Pearl. He was the godfather of modern artificial intelligence. Pearl's breakthrough had been to use what were called Bayesian belief networks. They were systems that could predict behaviour even when the information was incomplete. But to make the system work, Pearl and others had imported a model of human beings drawn from economics. They created what were called rational agents, software that mimicked human beings, but in a very simplified form. The model assumed that the agent would always act rationally in order to get what it wanted. Nothing more. One of the early utopians of cyberspace, Jaron Lanier, warned of the implications of this. The agent's model of what you are interested in will always be a cartoon model. And in return, you will see a cartoon version of the world through the agent's eyes. And, he added, it will never be clear who they are working for. You or someone else. New technology began to allow people to upload millions of images and videos into cyberspace. And the web, which up to that point had seemed like an abstract other world, began to look and feel like the real world.
Like, see your butts?
No, not like that.
From videos of animals, personal moments of experience, extraordinary events, to horrific terror videos, more and more was uploaded. And in a strange, sad twist, the first terrorist beheading video that was posted online was that of Judea Pearl's own son, Daniel Pearl. He was a journalist for the Wall Street Journal and had been kidnapped by radical Islamists in Pakistan. They recorded what they said was his confession and then his killing.
My name is Daniel Pearl. I'm a Jewish American. I come from on my father's side, a family of Zionists. My father's Jewish. My mother's Jewish. I'm Jewish. Only now do I think about that some of the people in Guantanamo Bay must be in a similar situation.
This was a new world that the old systems of power found it very difficult to deal with. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the security agencies secretly collected data from millions of people online. One program was called Optic Nerve. It took stills from the webcam conversations of millions of people across the world, trying to spot terrorists planning another attack. The program did not discover a single terrorist, but it did discover something else. A top secret assessment said, "Unfortunately, there are issues with undesirable images within the data. It would appear that a surprising number of people are using webcam conversations to show intimate parts of their body to the other person. Also, the fact that the software allows more than one person to view a webcam stream means that it appears to be being used to broadcast pornography." But increasingly, people were using the internet in other ways, to present themselves as they wanted to be seen.
Well, I guess a video blog is about me. I don't really want to tell you where I live because you could, like, stalk me.
The web drew people in because it was mesmerizing. It was somewhere that you could explore and get lost in any way you wanted. But behind the screen, like in a two-way mirror, the simplified agents were watching and predicting and guiding your hand on the mouse.
Stop!
I nearly threw my phone away. Stop. Stop. Pose.
Pose. And snap a selfie. There you go.
My name is Sweetie. The man asked me to take off my clothes. They undressed. They play with themselves. But what they don't know, I'm not real. I'm a computer model made piece by piece to track down this man who do this.
As the intelligence systems online gathered ever more data, new forms of guidance began to emerge. Social media created filters, complex algorithms that looked at what individuals liked and then fed more of the same back to them. In the process, individuals began to move, without noticing, into bubbles that isolated them from enormous amounts of other information. They only heard and saw what they liked. And the news feeds increasingly excluded anything that might challenge people's pre-existing beliefs.
Now it's all right. I know when my own life is coming. I say you will call out yourself.
Of cyberspace that was rising up seemed to be very much like William Gibson's original vision. That behind the superficial freedoms of the web were a few giant corporations with opaque systems that controlled what people saw and shaped what they thought. And what was even more mysterious was how they made their decisions about what you should like and what should be hidden from you. But then, the other utopian vision of cyberspace re-emerged.
Taking over the runway.
Take it!
After the financial crash of 2008, the politicians saved the banks. But they did practically nothing about the massive corruption that was revealed in its wake. And the reason they gave was that it might destabilise the system. Public anger burst out. The Occupy movement took over Wall Street, and then the Senate in Washington.
The issue is that certain individuals that are very wealthy have pretty much corrupted our political system. And this is like the heart of it. I mean, this is a Senate building. These people have been bought off, and they've basically corrupted our democracy, and it's literally killing people. I'm an Iraqi war vet. I went to Iraq in 2009 to see what happens firsthand when we let corruption rule our government and our democracy, and we're coming here today basically just to raise awareness.
What drove the Occupy movement was the original dream of the Internet that people like John Perry Barlow had outlined in the early 1990s. In his declaration of the independence of cyberspace, Barlow had described a new world, free of politics and the old hierarchies of power. A space where people connected together as equals in a network, and built a new society without leaders. Now, the Occupy movement set out to build that kind of society in the real world. The camps were to be the models. All the meetings used the idea of the human microphone. People throughout the crowd repeated a speaker's words so everyone could hear them.
We are now going to vote on whether to stay here for the next 2 hours or leave now.
But if someone wanted to challenge the speaker, the human amplifiers also had to repeat their words. So their voice had equal power. Each person was an autonomous individual who expressed what they believed. But together, they became components in a network that organized itself through the feedback of information around the system. You could organize people without the exercise of power.
Fighters in Egypt. Gamal Abdul on Main Street. Looks like chaos. Looks like policies running around and a few hundred people walking down the street.
Then, almost immediately, the Arab Spring began. The first revolution started in Tunisia, but it quickly spread to Egypt. On January the 25th, 2011, thousands of Egyptians came out in groups across Cairo and then started moving towards Tahrir Square. It seemed like a spontaneous uprising, but the internet had played a key role in organising the groups. One of the main activists was an Egyptian computer engineer called Wahil Gonim. He worked for Google in Egypt, but he had also set up the Facebook site that played the key role in organising the first protests. As hundreds of thousands took over Tahrir Square, Gonim gave an interview on Egyptian TV.
مش مصدقين يعني ايه شوية شباب على انا كنت بسميهم على الصفحة زمان عيال الفيسبوك هم كانوا بيسمونا زمانا ايام وقفات خالد سعيد في اول ما طلعنا خالص شوية العيال على الفيسبوك اللي بيعملوا شوية دوش مش مصدقين ان الشباب دول نزلوا بعشرات الالاف يوم 25 فارجوكم يا جماعة مفيش أبطال الأبطال هم الناس اللي في الشارع الأبطال هو كل واحد فينا مفيش النهاردة واحد ركب الحصان هو اللي بيضرب السرج ويحرك الناس اوعى حد يضحك عليكم ويقول لكم كده دي ثورة شباب الانترنت دي ثورة شباب الانترنت اللي بقت بعد كده ثورة شباب مصر اللي بعد كده بقت ثورة كل مصر.
But Gonim was also overwhelmed by the power this new technology had. That a computer engineer with a keyboard could call out thousands of people. Some of whom then died in the midst of the protests.
أنا عايز أقول لكل أم وكل أب بجد فقد ابنه. أنا آسف بس دي مش غلطتنا. والله العظيم غلطتنا. دي غلطة كل واحد كان ماسك في السلطان تبت فيها.
Many liberals in the West saw this as proof of the revolutionary power of the internet. Again, it seemed to be able to organize a revolution without leaders. A revolution powerful enough to topple a brutal dictator who had been backed by America and the West for 30 years. But the internet radicals were not the only ones who saw their dreams being fulfilled in the Arab Spring. Many of the political leaders of the West also enthusiastically supported the revolutions because it seemed to fit with their simple idea of regime change. It might have failed in Iraq, but now the people everywhere were rising up to rid themselves of the evil tyrants, and democracy would flourish. So when an uprising began in Libya, Britain, France and America supported it. And suddenly, Colonel Gaddafi stopped being a hero of the West. All the politicians and the public relations people and the academics who had all promoted him as a global thinker suddenly disappeared. And Gaddafi became yet again an evil dictator who had to be overthrown. His son Saif said, "The way these people are disowning me and my father is disgusting. Just a few months ago, we were being treated as honoured friends. Now that rebels are threatening our country, these cowards are turning on us." Colonel Gaddafi retreated to the ruins of the house that the Americans had bombed 30 years before. And addressed the world.
Those who love Muammar Gaddafi. Muammar Gaddafi is the glory. If I had a position, if I were a president, I would have resigned. I would have thrown my resignation in your face. But I have no position, no post. I have nowhere to resign from. I have my gun. I have my rifle. to fight for Libya. Withdraw your children from the streets. Take your children back. They are dragging your children. They're making your children drunk. And they're sending them to hell. Your children will die. What for?
In November 2011, a large convoy was spotted driving at high speed away from Colonel Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. An American drone, controlled from a shed outside Las Vegas, was sent to follow it. The operator fired a missile at the lead car of the convoy. Gaddafi then fled, looking for shelter from the oncoming rebel forces. He hid under the road in a drainage pipe. Instead of becoming a democracy, Libya began to descend into chaos. And the other revolutions were also failing. The Occupy camps had become trapped in endless meetings. And it became clear that there was a terrible confusion at the heart of the movement. The radicals had believed that if they could create a new way of organizing people, then a new society would emerge. But what they did not have was a picture of what that society would be like, a vision of the future. The truth was that their revolution was not about an idea. It was about how you manage things. And those who had started the revolution in Egypt came face to face with the same terrible fact. Social media had helped to bring people together in Tahrir Square. But once there, the internet gave no clue as to what kind of new society they could create in Egypt. The movement stalled. And a group that did have a powerful idea, the Muslim Brotherhood, rushed in to fill the vacuum. The Brotherhood took power in an election, and one of them, Mohamed Morsi, became president. The liberals and the left were shocked, and bit by bit, they turned back to the military, protesting, asking them to save the revolution from being captured by Islamists. In the spring of 2013, the military took action. They arrested the president and killed hundreds of his supporters who protested. And an extraordinary spectacle unfolded in Tahrir Square. Thousands of the liberal activists who had begun the revolution 2 years before, summoned by social media, now welcomed the military back by waving their laser pens at the helicopters flying overhead. The crowd had been summoned there, once again, by Facebook. Failure of the revolutions, it was not just the radicals. No one in the West had any idea of how to change the world. At home, the politicians had given so much of their power away to finance and the ever-growing managerial bureaucracies that they, in effect, had become managers themselves. While abroad, all their adventures had failed. and their simplistic vision of the world had been exposed as dangerous and destructive. But in Russia, there was a group of men who had seen how this very lack of belief in politics and dark uncertainty about the future could work to their advantage. What they had done was turn politics into a strange theatre, where nobody knew what was true or what was fake any longer. They were called political technologists, and they were the key figures behind President Putin. They had kept him in power, unchallenged, for 15 years. Some of them had been dissidents back in the 1970s, and had been powerfully influenced by the science fiction writings of the Strugatsky brothers. 20 years later, when Russia fell apart after the end of communism, they rose up and took control of the media. And they used it to manipulate the electorate on a vast scale. For them, reality was just something that could be manipulated and shaped into anything you wanted it to be. But then a technologist emerged who went much further. And his ideas would become central to Putin's grip on power. He was called Vladislav Surkov. Surkov came originally from the theatre world, and those who have studied his career say that what he did was take avant-garde ideas from the theatre and bring them into the heart of politics. Surkov's aim was not just to manipulate people, but to go deeper and play with and undermine their very perception of the world, so they are never sure what is really happening. Surkov turned Russian politics into a bewildering, constantly changing piece of theatre. He used Kremlin money to sponsor all kinds of groups, from mass anti-fascist youth organisations to the very opposite, neo-Nazi skinheads. And liberal human rights groups who then attacked the government. Surkov even backed whole political parties that were opposed to President Putin. But the key thing was that Surkov then let it be known that this was what he was doing, which meant that no one was sure what was real or what was fake in modern Russia. As one journalist put it, it's a strategy of power that keeps any opposition constantly confused. A ceaseless shape-shifting that is unstoppable because it is indefinable. Meanwhile, real power was elsewhere, hidden away behind the stage, exercised without anyone seeing it. And then, the same thing seemed to start happening in the West. By now, it was becoming ever more clear that the system had deep flaws. Every month, there were new revelations of most of the bank's involvement in global corruption, of massive tax avoidance by all the major corporations, of the secret surveillance of everyone's emails by the National Security Agency. Yet no one was prosecuted, except for a few people at the lowest levels. And behind it all, the massive inequality kept on growing. Yet the structure of power remained the same. Nothing ever changed, because nothing could be allowed to destabilize the system. But then, the shape-shifting began.
Thank you very much. So nice. So amazing. So amazing. What? That's okay. I love you more, okay?
The campaign that Donald Trump ran was unlike anything before in politics. Nothing was fixed. What he said, who he attacked, and how he attacked them was constantly changing and shifting. Trump attacked his Republican rivals as being all part of a broken and corrupt system. A politics where everyone could be bought, using words that could have come from the Occupy movement.
You've also donated to several Democratic candidates, Hillary Clinton included, Nancy Pelosi. You explained away those donations, saying you did that to get business-related favors. And you said recently, quote, when you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to do.
You better believe it.
So what specifically did they do?
If I ask them, if I need them, you know, most of the people on this stage I've given to, just so you understand, a lot of money. I will tell you that our system is broken. I give to many people. Before this, before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
So what'd
and that's
get?
A broken system.
So what?
But at the same time, Trump used the language of the extreme racist right in America, connecting with people's darkest fears, pushing them, and bringing those fears out into the open.
Get the fuck out of here! Our country! Proud fucking American! Made in USA, bitch! Made in fucking USA! I'll fucking cook my burrito, bitch! I'll fucking make my tortilla, motherfucker! And build that fucking wall for me! Trump! I love Trump! Fuck you! I love my country!
Yeah! I'll fuck like at least 10 of you up in one fucking city, you fucking pussy!
Come on!
Many of the facts that Trump asserted were also completely untrue. But Trump didn't care. He and his audience knew that much of what he said bore little relationship to reality.
Thank you very much.
This meant that Trump defeated journalism.
Beautiful place.
Because the journalists' central belief was that their job was to expose lies and assert the truth.
Greatly appreciated.
With Trump, this became irrelevant. Not surprisingly, Vladimir Putin admired this.
Что вы думаете о Дональде Трампе?
Ну, он яркий очень человек, талантливый, без всяких сомнений. Но это не наше дело определять его достоинство, это дело избирателей в Соединенных Штатах. Но он абсолютный лидер, мы сегодня видим, президентской гонки. Он говорит о том, что хочет перейти к другому уровню отношений, более плотному, глубокому уровню отношений с Россией. Но разве мы можем это не приветствовать? Конечно, мы это приветствуем. Все, что касается внутриполитических вещей, его обороты речи, что он использует для повышения своей популярности, повторю еще раз, это не наше дело оценивать эту его работу.
Спасибо.
The liberals were outraged by Trump, but they expressed their anger in cyberspace, so it had no effect. Because the algorithms made sure that they only spoke to people who already agreed with them. Instead, ironically, their waves of angry messages and tweets benefited the large corporations who ran the social media platforms. One online analyst put it simply, angry people click more. It meant that the radical fury that came like waves across the internet no longer had the power to change the world. Instead, it was becoming a fuel that was feeding the new systems of power and making them ever more powerful. But none of the liberals could possibly imagine that Donald Trump could ever win the nomination. It was just a giant pantomime.
And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke. Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. Donald Trump owns the Miss USA pageant, which is great for Republicans because it will streamline their search for a vice president. Donald Trump said recently he has a great relationship with the blacks, though unless the blacks are a family of white people, I bet he's mistaken.
But underneath the liberal disdain, both Donald Trump in America and Vladislav Surkov in Russia had realized the same thing, that the version of reality that politics presented was no longer believable, that the stories politicians told their people about the world had stopped making sense. And in the face of that, you could play with reality, constantly shifting and changing, and in the process, further undermine and weaken the old forms of power. Another force that was about to dramatically reveal just how weak politics had become in the West. Syria.
The attack happened here at a central police station in Damascus. Police say the bomber came up the stairs. Police then opened fire, and then police say he detonated the explosives. And the damage is here to see. Behind me, the pockmarked walls where the ball bearings hit. Blood splattered on the walls. And the force of the blast caused walls to collapse. And everything is topsy-turvy. Everything destroyed.
By now, Syria was being torn apart by a horrific civil war. What had started as part of the Arab Spring had turned into a vicious battle to the death between Bashar Assad and his opponents. And at the heart of the conflict was the force that his father had first brought to the West, suicide bombing. Back in the 1980s, Bashar Assad's father had seen suicide bombing as a weapon he could use to force the Americans out of the Middle East. But over the next 30 years, it had shifted and mutated into something that had now ended up doing the very opposite, tearing the Arab world apart. Hafez al-Assad's dream of a powerful and united Arab world was now destroyed. In Iraq, extremist Sunni groups had used suicide bombing as a way to start a sectarian war. And now, groups like ISIS brought the same techniques into Syria to attack not just Assad's son, but his fellow Shiites. Like his father, Bashar Assad retaliated with a vengeful fury, and the country fell apart.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
My fellow Americans, tonight I want to talk to you about Syria, why it matters, and where we go from here.
Faced by the war, Western politicians were bewildered. They insisted that Bashar Assad was evil. But then it turned out that his enemies were more evil and more horrific than him.
The question before the House today is how we keep the British people safe from the threat posed by ISIL. This is not about whether we want to fight terrorism. It's about how best we do that.
So Britain, America and France decided to bomb the terrorist threat. The effect of that was to help keep Assad in power. Then it became more confusing. Suddenly, the Russians intervened. President Putin sent hundreds of planes and combat troops to support Assad. But no one knew what their underlying aim was. They seemed to be using a strategy that Vladislav Surkov had developed in the Ukraine. He called it non-linear warfare. It was a new kind of war, where you never know what the enemy are really up to.
Allahu Akbar.
The underlying aim, Surkov said, was not to win the war, but to use the conflict to create a constant state of destabilized perception in order to manage and control.
Allahu Akbar.
In March 2016, the Russians suddenly announced with a great fanfare that they were leaving Syria. And a concert was held in the ruins of Palmyra to celebrate the withdrawal. But in reality, the Russians never left. They are still there, and still no one knows what they really want. And within Syria, there was a new Islamist ideologist who was determined to exploit the growing uncertainties in Europe and America. He was called Abu Musab al-Suri, the Syrian.
وبالمثال هذا يقع فيه كثير من الكتاب الذين اختاروا أن يكونوا كتاب جهاديين وكتاب للجهاد وما مارسوا الجهاد ولا مارسوا.
Al-Suri had originally worked with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, but he had turned against him. Al-Suri gave lectures that had a powerful effect on the Islamist movement. He argued that bin Laden had been wrong to attack the West head-on, because it created a massive military response that had almost destroyed Islamism. Instead, Al-Suri said, independent groups or individuals should stage random small-scale attacks on civilians in Europe and America. The aim was to spread fear, uncertainty and doubt, and undermine the already failing authority of Western politicians. The effect of the attacks shocked Europe and America, gave powerful force to the new politics of uncertainty and anxiety.
I'm sure that you with me share the absolute horror and total revulsion at what happened in Paris last Friday. And I'm afraid there is, and we have to be honest and frank about this and talk about these things without being fearful. There is a problem with some of the Muslim community in this country. There is a problem, and we have to be honest about it. Our politicians, I'm afraid, haven't had the guts.
This could be the great Trojan horse of all time. Because you look at the migration, study it, look at it. Now they'll start infiltrating with women and children.
Both the Brexit campaign in Britain and Donald Trump in America did exactly what Al-Suri had predicted. They used the fear to dramatize a world where everything, even going to a restaurant, had become a risky event. And what had been seen as doomed campaigns on the fringes of society that could never win became frighteningly real.
I am genuinely freaked out right now about this whole Brexit thing, because we had all been told that it wasn't going to happen. Like, it was going away. It was going away from Brexiting and onto the staying. And because I had this, like, bedrock belief. I have friends who like live and work in London. They said, oh, don't worry, we're very sensible people. This isn't going to happen. It's a lot of talk, but that we don't do that sort of stuff here. They were wrong. And it really kind of crushes my view of like what can happen that is bad that we don't think is going to happen. Like, it's just not supposed to happen.
I feel like we're watching the stirrings of fascism in Europe again. And I genuinely never thought it would be my country that did that. I thought this would be America. I thought America was the people who were so filled with hate. Not us. And I'm so disappointed. I'm so hurt.
Z.
ಬರುತ್ತಿದೆ ಎಲ್ಲಡೆ ಭೀಕರವಾಗಿ ಏಡ್ಸು ಏಡ್ಸು ಏಡ್ಸೋ ನಮ್ಮ ವೈರಿಗೂ ಬಾರದಿರಲಿ ಅದು ಓಡ್ಸು ಓಡ್ಸು ಓಡ್ಸೋ.
ಹೆಚ್ಚಿನ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ಸಂಪರ್ಕದ ಸೋಂಕುಗಳು ವಾಸಿಗುತ್ತವೆ, ಆದರೆ ಏಡ್ಸ್ಗೆ ಚಿಕಿತ್ಸೆ ಇಲ್ಲ.
ಏಡ್ಸ್ಗೆ ತುತ್ತಾಗಿರುವ ವ್ಯಕ್ತಿಗಳಿಗೆ ನಿಮ್ಮಿಂದ ಬೇಕಾಗಿರುವುದು ಭೇದ ಭಾವ ಉಪೇಕ್ಷೆಯಲ್ಲ, ಅವರಿಗೆ ಅಗತ್ಯವಿರುವುದು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಪ್ರೀತಿ, ಅನುಕಂಪ ಮತ್ತು ಬೆಂಬಲ.
ಕಾಂಡಮ್ ಅಥವಾ ನಿರೋಧ ಬಳಕೆ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ಸಂಗಾತಿಗಳ ಸಂಖ್ಯೆ ಹೆಚ್ಚಷ್ಟು ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ತಗುಲುವ ಅಪಾಯವೂ ಹೆಚ್ಚುತ್ತದೆ. ಒಂದು ಪಕ್ಷ ನಿಮಗೆ ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ಇದೆ ಎಂದು ಗೊತ್ತಾದರೆ ನಿಮ್ಮ ಆರೋಗ್ಯವನ್ನು ಕಾಪಾಡಿಕೊಂಡು ಹೋಗಲು ನಿಮಗೆ ಮತ್ತು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಕುಟುಂಬದವರಿಗೆ ಸ್ವಯಂ ಪ್ರೇರಿತ ಸಮಾಲೋಚನೆ ಮತ್ತು ಪರೀಕ್ಷಾ ಕೇಂದ್ರದವರು ಸಹಾಯ ಮಾಡುವರು.
ಚಿಕಿತ್ಸೆಗೊಳಗಾಗದ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ರೋಗಗಳಾದ ಯೋನಿಯ ಸ್ರಾವ ಮತ್ತು ಗಾಯ, ಹುಣ್ಣು, ಕಿಬ್ಬೊಟ್ಟೆಯಲ್ಲಿ ನೋವು ಮತ್ತು ಸಂಭೋಗದ ಸಮಯದಲ್ಲಿ ನೋವುವಿರುವ ಸ್ತ್ರೀಯರಿಗೆ ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ತಗುಲುವ ಅಪಾಯ ಹೆಚ್ಚು.
ಏಡ್ಸ್ ಬಾರದಂತೆ ತಡೆಗಟ್ಟಲು ನೀವು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಸಂಗಾತಿ ಇಬ್ಬರಲ್ಲೂ ಪರಸ್ಪರ ವಿಶ್ವಾಸ, ಪ್ರೀತಿ, ನಿಷ್ಠೆ ಇರಲಿ. ನಿಮ್ಮದು ಏಕಪತಿ ಮತ್ತು ಏಕಪತ್ನಿತ್ವ ಸಂಬಂಧವಾಗಿರಲಿ.
What's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying, for Men in Hip Hop. Really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
There are many arguments against the death penalty. It's not a deterrent against the crimes that it punishes. Society who use the death penalty don't have lower crime rates than those that do. When a country abolishes the death penalty, they are not plunged into criminal chaos. But even if the death penalty did reduce crime rates, would it then be acceptable? The death penalty targets the economically disadvantaged, those who can't afford good legal counsel, those without a voice in society. There's a saying in the US, capital punishment means that those without the capital get the punishment. Statistics show this is true. But would it be acceptable if people from all sections of society were executed? Does killing a rich man make killing a poor man right? The death penalty is irreversible and results in the death of innocence. When someone is dead, a retrospective pardon is of little use to them or their family. Since 1990, in China, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the USA, there have been 51 recorded executions of child offenders, some as young as 14 years old. But even if no more innocents or children are killed, should we tolerate the death penalty? The death penalty is never acceptable. It abuses two of our most basic human rights. Everyone has the right to live, and no one shall be subject to torture. The death penalty obviously kills people, but it also tortures, physically by the brutal nature of execution, and psychologically by forcing individuals to wait to be killed. They wait sometimes for decades, while others are led to their deaths. The horror of this waiting is unimaginable. Human rights are thus called because they apply to all human beings. They belong to all of us equally. An attack on these fundamental rights anywhere is an attack against all of us. The right to life is inalienable. It cannot be given and it cannot be taken away. No matter how terrible the crime, in a world full of uncertainty, human rights are a clearly drawn line, a line between what is right and what is wrong, the line between imprisonment and execution. Every individual facing the death penalty is, whatever they stand accused of, still a human being. However much we revile them, however much we are outraged by their actions, however much we want revenge, they are still human beings. They may well have killed and tortured. They've crossed the line. But do we really want to join them?
Sisters, brothers, friends, and supporters. Well, here it is, another year. I believe it was right after I was illegally convicted in Fargo, North Dakota, when I wrote a statement telling everyone that my freedom would only come after the masses had demanded it. But first, we would have to unite and organize to reach them. So far, we have been unable to do so. Yes, we have reached millions who signed my petitions. We circulated throughout the world, asking for my release. Through most of those good peoples are from Europe. But we also made a lot of gains here in the United States. At one time, we had 55 members of Congress sign a letter for a new trial or my release. 55 members is historical. No other prisoner in history has ever been able to accomplish this, nor has anyone else, individually. And there are other accomplishments we have made and won here in the United States. Still, I sit in prison, not because I am guilty of the alleged crime I was illegally convicted of, but because we are still unable to reach the masses here in America. The reasons for this is not because the American peoples do not care or want to help, but because we have been unable to reach them. Personally, I believe the majority of them do care and want to help. We sense this from the ones we are able to reach. We are moving forward very slowly in this freedom campaign of mine. The reason for this is we just do not have the financial resources to move forward at the pace we would like to be. This is the real and only reason we have been unable to reach the peoples of the United States. Nothing is free here in America, not justice or the media. So although there still is no light at the end of the tunnel for me on my freedom, we continue struggling forward. I continue to search for the hope and strength I need to survive. I continue to pray and hope that one day I will get the support I need from the American people, and one day I will still be able to walk out of prison. So my hopes and spirits are still high at my 62 years of age. I can tell you in this continued struggle, we are still finding bits and pieces of new evidence to file new appeals on. Those of you who have followed my case closely, I can imagine are thinking, how can this be, as there has been so many constitutional violations already? But the same old problem exists. The courts continue to cover up the criminal acts in my conviction committed by my prosecutors. Your help is still needed more than ever. Please give us all you can. Thank you. No shot in the spirit of Crazy Horse. Stop any week. Go on, be last. Leonard Peltier.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news session.
These are independent journalists who are out there trying to cover a story, and now they're facing charges. The Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, is doing their goddamnedest to get the word out, to let people know what's going on. CPJ is aware of at least 10 journalists covering the story who are facing charges. If you go to the Committee to Protect Journalists website, you'll find what they're charged with and the details. The details of the cases against these 10. That's all CPJ knows of. There may be more. And some of those who are facing charges have told CPJ, that police use some pretty fascist tactics. Beat the shit out of them. Pushed them around. Okay, didn't beat the shit out of them, but put the pain on them. Put the pain on them. Oh, what's the matter? Is your arm twisted? Oh, well, you're resisting arrest. If you stop resisting arrest, I'll stop trying to break your fucking arm, all right? And give me your iPhone. Really? Heavy-handed tactics? These militarized fascist cops out there ignored or dismissed their press credentials. And this is a part that is so goddamn galling. I mean, this is what drives me crazy. These guys and women were arrested even though they were following dispersal orders or commands to stay behind police lines. And the journalist said that the burden of legal costs or risk of further charges if they are arrested again has discouraged them from covering other protests at the Dakota
Access. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
And that's the way the fascist state works, especially when it's in its infancy. You want to cover what's going on out here? Come on, asshole. Come on out.
Good morning.
Last iPhone. Bring your notepad. We will bust your ass. We will arrest you. We will charge you with shit like participating in a riot. Now, you want to come on? Come on. And then this is a part that is like taking a whole goddamn box of Morton salt and after ripping with a paring knife the length of your arm, pour the salt in. That's what I'm talking about. The Morton County Sheriff's Department told the Committee to Protect Journalists, quote, that it respects the important role journalists play in our democracy and in the coverage of the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. We do. We really, really, really do. What do you want us to say? That we're fascist fuckers who are going to slam everybody you send out here into the court system out here in North Dakota? What do you want us to say? Of course we respect press freedom. As long as you assholes do it from South Dakota. And then when the Committee to Protect Journalists asked the Sheriff's Department to comment on specific allegations made by journalists, the Sheriff's Department did the equivalent of just raising the middle finger to the CPJ, and that is no answer. No answer. Jenny Monette, M-O-N-E-T, I guess you pronounce that way. Jenny Monette, freelance journalist who has been reporting on the pipeline protests for several months. This comes right off the CPJ website. She was charged with criminal trespass and engaging in a riot. She was arrested February 1st while covering the dismantling of an encampment known as Last Child Camp. Monette said that she had expected the assignment to be like any other reporting trip, but when the police surrounded the camp, she got a bad feeling and texted a colleague, quote, "Heads up, might get arrested, big raid about to go down, and I'm trapped," end quote. Monette, who contributes to outlets including Yes Magazine and the PBS NewsHour website, wrote about her experience in an article for the Oneida Nation-owned Indian Country Media Network. In the piece, she said that despite showing police her media pass and walking away when instructed to do so, she was arrested, strip-searched, and held in jail for 25 hours before being charged. Jahan Hafetz, an award-winning Egyptian Samoan, how's that, journalist, who also faces charges, told CPJ that she thought reporting in North Dakota would be, quote, a walk in the park, end quote. This journalist has covered conflict in the Middle East, police brutality in Brazil. She writes for outlets including The Real News Network, Al Jazeera America, and she said she was surprised by what she described as heavy-handed police tactics and compared covering Standing Rock to reporting on conflict overseas. She said, she told CPJ, quote, "These are not American tactics of policing. It's clear to me that covering this is dangerous," end quote. Covering this is dangerous. How about that? Covering it. Providing information to the American public. Doing the job that the First Amendment says has to be done is dangerous. According to the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, journalists don't have any special privileges when it comes to trespassing. That's according to Greg Leslie, who's the legal defense director at the committee. He said, quote, "Prosecutors and judges should recognize that the public is best served by allowing reporters to document the scene. If protesters are engaging in criminal acts, the public should know that. Likewise, if government agents are overreacting or committing civil rights violation, the public needs to know that too," end quote. And then, of course, Leslie added the obvious. There are times when a journalist will go on private land to chase a story. Leslie went on. He said, quote, "Any criminal trespass law should require an intent to do something illegal. Covering a news story shouldn't suffice to establish that intent. Courts," he went on, don't often see it this way. And they figure trespass is trespass. But it's inevitable that some very public newsworthy stories, like officers arresting protesters, will occur on private land, and there's a significant public interest in showing journalists to cover those events, allowing journalists to cover those events, end quote. Back to Jahan Hafetz, the award-winning Egyptian Samoan journalist. She published an account and provided video footage of the mass arrest on October 22nd, too, and appeared in The Intercept. She said she told officers she was a journalist and pleaded with them not to arrest her. She told CPJ, quote, "We were subjected to strip searches, which is humiliating. People who looked native or were not white were targeted and told to spread body parts or jump up and down." And Monette, who's Native American, also told CPJ that she was subjected to a strip search, but said that when she talked to white women booked at the same time, they told her they had been allowed to keep their bras on during the search. Oh, let's look at some Indian titty. Oh, look ahead. Oh, goddamn. Jump up and down, bitch. Right? That's where we live. You don't like my language? I don't give a shit. That's where we live. Oh, and the sheriff's office did not immediately respond to requests for comment about these claims. You know, the old middle finger. And Hafiz, Jihan Hafiz, she told the Committee to Protect Journalists that authorities informed her that if she was arrested for the same offense again, she could be held in jail until her June court date. She said, quote, I still get close to direct actions, but I'm scared. To be in jail and have the control of your life in someone else's hands is scary. I still try to be as close as possible. To be distant and film something means nothing. To other journalists, Sarah LaFleur Vetter, whose coverage of Standing Rock featured as a mini-documentary in The Guardian, and Lorenzo Cerna, a journalist with the nonprofit media group Unicorn Riot, were arrested the same day as Hafiz. Both of them said they identified themselves as journalists at the time of arrest. Sarah, who was filming for part of a feature-length documentary about three Standing Rock protesters, told CPJ that police seized her camera equipment. And the public information officer for the Morton County Sheriff's Department, where all the shit's going down, told CPJ in an emailed statement, quote, when journalists are covering an incident, they need to provide credentials to law enforcement when asked. If asked by law enforcement to leave an area that is private property, they need to do so to avoid committing criminal trespass. If they don't leave after repeated requests by law enforcement, request my ass, by law enforcement to do so, they are subject to being arrested for committing criminal trespass, regardless of their credentials as a journalist. Which is another way of saying, fuck journalists. Right. And take note of this. Nearly all of the journalists facing charges are freelance or from small independent outlets, such as Unicorn Riot, which is a volunteer media collective started about 2 years ago. And that's made it very difficult for people to fight the charges. Do you know how much you get paid if you work for these small media outlets? I have to chuckle because in the late 70s, I was a managing editor of a newspaper, weekly newspaper, alternative paper here in Atlanta. Had a big advertising base, yada, yada, yada. We put out 64-page issues. We put out big papers, kind of like the Chicago Reader or the Village Voice. And I worked my ass off. And I was paid $75 a week. Now, $75 a week then and now is shit. But I did it because I wanted to learn, and I was dedicated to the objective of this weekly paper. So I know what it's like to be busting your ass, getting stories, doing layout, getting shit to a printer, taking photographs. What do you call them? Not negatives, but never mind. And this is back in the day when every single word that went in the paper had to be typed, and then you have to lay it out. You know, if you've done that before, you know what I'm talking about. There was no money for anything. I lived in a collective house. There were about seven of us that lived together just to survive. Oh, I don't mean we were, you know, eating bread and drinking water. I'm not trying to get dramatic here. But when these journalists say, these independent, small journalists say, you know, I can't afford to risk it anymore because if they lock me up, I can't even make bail, much less handle the sentence. But that's how it works. Where are the big-time journalists on this story, huh? I'm not talking about a camera crew that goes out and does some footage, and then the anchor can sit on his ass or her ass back in a nice, comfortable studio someplace in New York or L.A. and go, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. No, they don't do that. Big-time journalists and big-time news outlets, they might make an effort when it first starts, when all the engines show up and the teepees are raised and there's a lot of drumming and shit, you know. Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Look at that. Man, that's like a Western movie. Look at that. Ah, goddamn. But they get real bored real quick. You know why? Because they know their audience doesn't want to see this shit. I don't want to see no Indians out there protesting. I don't care. It's a goddamn pipeline. I don't care. I don't care. I thought we whipped their asses a long time ago. I don't care about this. And the supervising editors and producers, they know that. So after that first spurt, they're gone. So who's left? Who's left to cover this horror that's going on out there? Fuck your sacred ground. What are you talking about? Your people aren't even buried in a cemetery. As far as the river is concerned, none of your goddamn business what happens to the river, right? That's the attitude. So what would happen if the big-time journalists, huh? How about Jonathan Carl? Send his ass out there, right? He always does that stand-up in front of the White House. Bah, 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 bah. Send Jonathan Carl out there. Get David Muir. I mean, Muir, whatever, the anchor at ABC. I mean, he's covered some shit. He really has. Send him out there. Please. It's just a pipeline. So that's what's happening at the Dakota Access Pipeline. Unicorn Riot, that collective, has been covering the protests since April last year. And according to The Intercept, its journalists, who often live stream events from the protest site, are often mistaken for activists. Oh, I guess that's because they don't have the new safari coat and the really cool $150 scarf and shit, right? The three Unicorn Riot journalists with whom CPJ spoke said they were arrested despite attempting to follow police orders. One told CPJ that he used to be an activist. That's Nico Georgiadis, a reporter for Unicorn Riot. He said, I'm worried about the fines. I don't have $1,000 for a fine. He said he was arrested alongside Chris Schiano, also from Unicorn Riot in North Dakota, on September 13th, after they filmed protesters locking themselves to construction equipment. Georgiadis said that he stayed behind the police line as per instruction, but was still arrested. He told CPJ that he used to be an activist, but had made a conscious decision to switch to reporting. He said, quote, if I was participating, I wouldn't have a camera and wouldn't be asking people what was happening if we embed in the camps. It doesn't mean we aren't journalists. When ABC embeds in the military, it doesn't make them soldiers. Well, it doesn't make them journalists either. Come on, we've all seen that shit. And according to CPJ, most of the journalists face Class B misdemeanor charges or criminal trespassing or engaging in a riot. A few face more serious charges. Myron Dewey, a Native American journalist who runs Digital Smoke Signals. How's that? A website that includes news, videos, and forums, faces a Class A misdemeanor charge of stalking for allegedly using a drone. If he's convicted, He's facing a year in the slam and a $2,000 fine. Other journalists with whom CPJ spoke said that this man's footage and cultural perspective had been invaluable in understanding the protests. So the court hearings for two of the 10 journalists are scheduled for this week, first week in March. It's already Thursday. Well, so that's that. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back. Stick around. Malloy here. You know, the one question I've been asked over and over during my three-decade broadcast career